You're listening to Catch the Current, the holly jolliest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. This week is our special 2026 Look Ahead episode, where we're talking not only food and retail trends hitting the seafood space in the new year, but also what the industry is facing in the coming months, from the Marine Mammal Protection Act bans to tariffs.
We don't have a crystal ball and we can't predict the future, but we do have our knowledgeable team of Undercurrent reporters joining us on the pod this week.
Cue up that game show music and let's introduce this week's guests.
Joining us now on the line is Undercurrent News editorial director Cliff White, America's editor Jason Hoffman, and Price reporters Gary Morrison and Ben Fisher. Dream team assembled. Now we've got a lot to cover, so let's get right to it with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, or MMPA import ban, which Cliff has so graciously been covering for us these past few weeks leading up to the January 1st implementation date. So Cliff, is it essentially that the ball drops at midnight and a ban on billions of dollars worth of seafood takes effect?
Ball's dropping, Amanda. It's happening. I don't think every U.S. importer is fully aware that this is happening like within a couple weeks. So if you're listening to this and you haven't checked whether any of your imports are impacted by this, do that now.
This is your rude awakening.
Right. Really rude. This is going to impact 240 fisheries from 46 countries. So check the list, just like Santa. Check it twice. It's up on the NOAA website. And this is going to impact a whole ton of wild-caught species that are imported into the U.S.
So it's a lot, and we're only going to touch, you know, a couple species here. But NOAA Fisheries told importers in a webinar this past week that a government-issued certification of admissibility, or COA, will be required for any shipments entering the U.S. Can you explain what the COA is and what happens if a shipment arrives in the U.S. without one?
Yeah. So all the nitty-gritties in the article. So if you're looking for details, NOAA provided a rundown of what qualifies, what needs a COA and what doesn't. But basically, if there's any doubt that what you're importing could be on that banned list, you're going to need a COA. For example, if you're importing mahi from Ecuador or Peru, which are both on the list, it's just their drift net or gill net fisheries which are impacted, but you need to provide a COA attesting that that mahi is not from those banned fisheries. So you need someone in Ecuador or Peru to sign that thing, and then you need to sign it or someone from your company needs to attest that you're bringing in legal product. If you don't have that, CBP is going to block your shipment from coming into the U.S. It's not going to leave the port. So I don't know what happens to it after that point. I don't know if you can subsequently attest that it's okay, but better to avoid that situation altogether and get it done right. This goes into effect January 1st. It doesn't matter if the stuff was caught before January 1st. If it's after that date, you're going to need a COA for a lot of different seafood products.
So it doesn't matter if it's already on the water coming in.
Doesn't matter. If it hits port January 1st or after, you need a COA for anything that could be in any sort of gray area for imports. That's fisheries from 46 different countries. So check it out.
And I know your article covered tuna, it covered mahi, but Gary, from your side of the markets, crab meat is also a big one. So is this something that, looking at 2026, has this been something that's kind of been dangling over your head of what you think is going to be really haunting the industry this year?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Cliff laid it out pretty well, right? But those that import crab meat were given a temporary stay from five fisheries in four main importing countries, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka. And, you know, those four countries account for 70% of the crab meat imports last year. In 2024, the U.S. imported 27,705 metric tons, or right around 61 million pounds of crab meat worth $672 million. So, you know, without that stay, 70% of that would have been right taken out of the market. That put all kinds of upward price pressure on crab meat this year throughout 2025 because there was that supply risk. Now that it's been stayed, there's still some volatility and some upward pressure in the market, right? Because there's still a final determination that needs to be made. So I think, from the crab meat importers that I've been talking to, just from the state countries, they're still having some sort of contingency plan put in place in case there's an adverse determination, right? And some or all of these fisheries or countries are now banned in the later date. So what they're doing is they're talking about maybe importing, front-loading imports like we saw in the shrimp market in 2025. In early 2026 for crab meat to get the supply here to mitigate some of that volatility and supply risk later down in 2026 if an adverse action does affect all the fisheries. In addition, they're looking to diversify their sourcing in case one or just a couple of these fisheries are banned so that they have the ability to source from different nations. But it's certainly a cautious tone to the market. They do believe that they will ultimately win, but it is uncertain right now. And so they do have to plan. And that's all putting additional cost pressures on importers, in addition to some of the tariffs that have been laying over the head of those guys all year.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks, Cliff. And more information on the MMPA import ban can be found on the website. Check our show notes. And believe it or not, Cliff's got even more coverage coming in the new year as everything takes effect. So moving away from MMPA, Jason, this next question is for you. Did you think that tariffs would continue to be a hot topic carrying us into the new year?
I did. I don't think it was hard to see. We are very strange times. Never been in a situation like this before, at any stage. The tariffs that started back in April were like 10%, and then they spiked up in August, and they multiplied for several countries. I just recently got to see the tariff revenues for the month of September, the most recent available, and they are almost double what they were in August. So, like, the tariff revenue keeps getting higher and higher. The tariffs are higher and higher, and we're starting to get a sense that this is having an impact on the market. I think at the beginning, companies were willing to eat some of those tariff costs, but
Not anymore.
not anymore. We're starting to see them now kind of start to show up. But maybe not at the extreme of the tariff, but it's some percentage of the tariff. There's only so long a company can, lose that margin and continue to eat that. So it's happening. Now we are on the edge of a cliff. I don't know what's going to happen next. The U.S. Supreme Court's supposed to have a ruling. It
Yes,
could
that cliff.
happen.
This could be a game changer. This is a
This
serious
could
cliff, yeah.
be the outcome of what happens if the U.S. Supreme Court says those tariffs were unconstitutional. Could be severe. It could cause the Trump administration to have to repay the tariffs. But the court might not go there. The court might not order that. It might just end the tariffs. Either way, it's a massive disruptive change. If we go forward with the tariffs, it's not great because, like I was saying, companies are really starting to hurt trying to absorb these costs. Maybe we'll get a trade deal or two in the future that'll make it easier if the tariffs continue. Maybe not. Some of the problem too is that the president has been kind of in and out on like what he's going to do next. Right now they're talking about the Canada-Mexico deal, right? That was all settled a couple months ago. It seemed like the Canadian seafood was safe from tariffs, but they had a hearing the other day, and afterwards the USTR said, "Yeah, we're not crazy about this deal." And so will that get blown up? Will that mean tariffs on Canadian seafood in the future? It just we don't know. It's such a it's such a world of unknowns right now.
Now, Ben, Gary, you guys are covering the lobster market. Now, the USMCA agreement, can you talk about what this agreement means on your radar for 2026?
Yeah, there's a huge flow of live lobster in between the US and Canada. And to this point, that has not been affected by tariffs. And if that agreement gets blown up, that's going to slap a, double-digit percentage on a very, very substantial trade flow. So that's something that I don't think anybody in the industry really wants to see.
And the tariff that China has on Canada right now is certainly impacting trade flows, right? So, do you think that's going to be an issue if there's still an advantage here in the United States? I mean, I know nobody wants it, right? I mean, I don't think anybody expects it, but what's that look like if they
I
both
think
have
that
some pretty big tariffs?
so US exports of lobster to China are down, but I think they're up more than they would be without the Canada-China trade friction. So I think the U.S. is a bit thankful for that, EV auto tariff that Canada has slapped on Chinese automobiles. And I think the lobster industry is thankful for it. Canada, the Canadian fishery probably is not.
And, a lot of that lobster that comes across is for processing. And I know, processors had elevated prices for tails and meat this year. So any additional costs will certainly be looked at. I mean, Jason was talking about the state of the consumer and how it might affect, or he will be. We've always been talking about it. And any additional costs on meat, especially in the prime summertime season, starting out from a tight inventory position and high prices now, might impact, pricing if we have additional costs that have to be layered on. So certainly the industry will be watching that, Amanda.
We've talked about crab. We've talked about lobster. Let's keep along with the shellfish. Let's talk about shrimp. And I tell you, I didn't expect radioactive shrimp on my 2025 bingo card. I think that was a shock for all of us. And who knows what 2026 is going to bring our way. But one thing I've been watching heavily is the labeling issue that's been taking place in the U.S. U.S. producers have kind of really taken a stance and have been really fighting back. They've taken this radioactive shrimp situation and kind of really rallied behind it, pushing retailers to, pull back and try to push for more domestic product to be hitting shelves and to be on the menu. And you're seeing that too, still with groups that are, targeting restaurants and testing this shrimp to make sure that restaurants are accurately promoting the shrimp. So what I've been really interested to see is, Gary, on the shrimp side, is what do you think is going to happen in 2026? What are the big markets? Is Indonesia still going to have an issue with the certificate that they have to have coming in from certain areas regarding the radioactive activity?
No, I think, long-term, it probably provided a benefit to Indonesia, because now they can say that, their shrimp is certified, free of any, not only radioactivity, but, any other, element that you don't want to do. So I think, if it comes down to it, it might have given them, a short-term pain, but long-term opportunity against some other countries. But, we're seeing the same thing in the shrimp industry. We're talking to people. You have groups going down, especially to the south, where a lot of our domestic shrimp is landing, and making sure that restaurants that are advertising domestic shrimp are actually serving domestic shrimp to try to push, consumption of the USA product. So, we're seeing that. I mean, I think some of the things that the industry is going to be looking for in 2026 is certainly the global supply. Ecuador continues to produce as much as they can and continues to grow year over year. And if you look at Ecuador exports to the US through October, they're up 26%. So we're going to be setting up, if things move the way they are in the final 2 months of the year when data comes out, to have a record year of shrimp from Ecuador into the U.S. They're making a play to grow market share, and they're doing that irrespective of the tariff situation. So the global supply is certainly one thing to watch. And then, tariffs are always top of mind, given what Jason talked about before. And it's really about not only the tariffs that are on now, but what trade deals may come into play. If India is reduced from that 50% tariff that they have now, that alters things a lot. India being the number one source of imported farm-raised shrimp into the United States, because importers here are balancing that cautious belief that there is going to be a trade deal. So they don't want to import as much as they can, because then they're stuck with expensive inventory as cheaper flows come into the United States. So it's a really delicate balancing act for them. And I think they would rather certainty than not. And, I think that's, the two things that we're watching for in 2026.
That 50% tariff on India, I think when we look back at 2025 and we think about all the things that happened, some crazy stuff happened, I think that single tariff on India's shrimp is probably the biggest thing that happened in the entire seafood industry last year. It seems like it was the number one source of shrimp for the U.S., and it's definitely making a difference in terms of how much is imported. Looking forward into the new year, if that 50% tariff doesn't go away, maybe by the end of the year, but if it doesn't go away soon, do you think we will start to see any dramatic changes in terms of sourcing of shrimp from other countries, or do you think somehow we keep importing Indian shrimp?
Yeah, I think India is going to be a consistent partner with the U.S. And I think we talked about it in other pods and webinars, but they have the capability and the expertise for some shrimp types and some shrimp species that other areas don't. So as much as Ecuador is trying to push the envelope, they do have capacity issues for peeled and deveined shrimp. So if the U.S. consumer continues to crave convenience and want P&Ds, they want easy peel, then we're going to certainly have to look to our Asian partners. And it's when you're looking at that, it's the tariff difference between the partners, right? And how they can absorb it, not only the gross number of 50%. I mean, you're talking some of these other countries, of high double digits as well. So it's how well they can absorb it. But I think India is going to be a really large partner and an important partner, like they've been for the past years. I think they'll figure it out. And I think ultimately there is optimism that some sort of trade deal will bring tariffs to, some of the levels that have been struck with some of the other countries.
So, Jason, we've covered almost everything, but I'm gonna leave you with scallops. Just a quick thoughts on what you see in 2026.
Wow, 2025 was not, it was a better year for scallops than in 2024 in terms of landings, but not great. They're going to end up landing about 17 million pounds over the course of the season, which ends in March, at the end of March. The New England Fishery Management Council passed a framework just recently that basically keeps landings at about the same rate going into the next year. And so supply is not great now. Supply is not going to be great next year. I think there's going to be more pressure on imports. People are going to start looking more at import sources like Japan. Can Japan produce enough to satisfy the U.S. market, fill the gap? I don't know. I think scallops are going to get expensive.
More expensive.
More expensive, yeah. They're already expensive.
All right, moving on to salmon. Lauren, take it away.
All right, so jump on for a long ride. I've got a lot to cover. So we're going to look ahead to 2026. The salmon market is basically trying to find its footing after a pretty wild 2025. Last year was all about oversupply, especially out of Norway. Harvest surged, prices collapsed, and both Europe and the US were flooded with fish. And Chile wasn't much better off, with prices sliding to post-COVID lows as demand lagged and inventories piled up. So for farmed Atlantic salmon, growth is slowing fast. Global production is expected to grow only 2 to 3% next year, maybe even less. Norway is flattening out as fish in the water dropped last year, while Chile is likely to lead what little growth there is. That shift matters, though, because we're moving away from a volume-driven market and back towards replacement costs setting the tone. Trade policy is another huge factor, especially for the US. Chile has a clear tariff advantage over Norway, and that's already reshaping trade flows. Chilean salmon is becoming more competitive in US retail and food service, while Norway is leaning harder into Asia, specifically China. And China, by the way, is now Norway's anchor market. Demand there is growing fast, but it's still price sensitive. When prices jump too much, volume tends to pull back. So exporters are going to need some discipline there. And in the near term, inventory is still the biggest drag on prices. There's a lot of fish that needs to clear, especially in Europe, which is why early 2026 pricing could stay capped. But as stocks thin and production growth stays muted, the market should firm later in the year. And finally, the wild card for salmon is biology. We've got disease risk, warming waters, weather, and all of that still has the power to change the story very quickly. Canada adds another layer of uncertainty, and land-based salmon still isn't ready to save the day. So the bottom line for 2026 is farm salmon is recalibrating after a rough year, and that's going to shape substitution and pricing dynamics across global markets. And Ben, you cover our wild salmon markets, so let us know what's happening there.
So I think in 2026, the big question is going to be what the harvests are going to look like, not just in the US, but globally. I mean, this year in Alaska, even though there was a good Bristol Bay season, Alaska still missed its preseason sockeye forecast. And all the other species, the other four species of salmon, hit anywhere between 81 and 86% of their preseason forecasts. So all eyes are on next year for what the season is going to look like. And of course, with pink salmon being a species that runs every 2 years, there's not going to be a big pink harvest next year. So it's just going to be the four other species. And early forecasts are not good in major salmon producing areas of Alaska. In Japan, on the other side of the Pacific, Japan is having its own crisis. This year's Hokkaido harvest was a disaster, I think, for lack of a better term. It was 67% lower than it was the year prior. And now they're facing this chum salmon shortage, an Ikura crisis. Prices are going to skyrocket. So I think the biggest question for salmon in 2026 is what harvest is going to look like. Russia was the sort of the one outlier where the harvest was okay this year. But because of the geopolitical situation, much of that is staying domestically. And the two countries that are catching a lot of salmon that move across borders didn't catch a ton this year and are not projected to catch much next year.
All right. For whitefish, whitefish is heading into 2026 with kind of a split personality. On paper, there's plenty of fish. Pollock quotas are still large. Flatfish quotas haven't collapsed. Tilapia production is massive. And Vietnam keeps pushing Pangasius into the market. But underneath that headline volume, the market feels much more structural than it used to. It's being shaped less by week-to-week demand and more by policy, access, tariffs, and compliance. And that makes the traditional whitefish playbook a lot less reliable heading into 2026. So starting with cod and haddock, there is no longer just a quota story there. Even when Norway and Russia agree on headline numbers, the real question is how much fish actually makes it into the channels that set global replacement costs. So we've got sanctions, routing issues, insurance, financing, all of that affects whether supply is truly available. So you end up with a market that can look adequate on a spreadsheet, but still trade like it's short. There's fewer spot offers, selective processing, and pricing that stays pins near the higher end because sellers don't need to chase volume. So for 2026, cod and haddock look structurally supported unless access improves or demand breaks meaningfully. Pollock is a little bit different. This looks like a constraint year, not so much of a cut year. The Bering Sea quota is basically flat, but harvesting it efficiently is the real challenge. We've got bycatch, there's timing issues, fleet behavior, and processing capacity that all matter. There's also a growing narrative shift around biomass and yields, not necessarily fewer fish, but different fish. So size mix and recovery matter a lot for fillets versus blocks and surimi. So pollock pricing in 2026 won't hinge on scarcity alone, but on whether consistent volume actually shows up when buyers need it. Yellowfin sole is another great example of how inventories can hide a squeeze. Right now, inventory stocks here in the US are doing the work of supply. But once those buffers thin, buyers can quickly find themselves back in replacement cost territory with fewer offers and more rationing and a slow, stubborn grind higher, especially on larger specs there. Getting into tilapia, that's probably the clearest two-speed market in the near term. It looks oversupplied. We have weak export pricing, cautious buyers, hand-to-mouth purchasing. But underneath that, low farm gate prices, farmer losses, and reduced stocking are setting up a fragile 2026. And then you add in tariff uncertainty and you get a market that looks cheap today, but unstable tomorrow. So the biggest risk for buyers is assuming today's low prices mean long-term abundance. Moving to Pangasius, that's still one of the healthier demand stories in whitefish, but even there, growth may run into biological limits. Fingerling availability and weather disruptions don't show up immediately. They show up gradually when harvestable volumes fail to materialize. That can flip the market from steady growth to selective availability pretty quickly. So the big theme tying all of this together for 2026 is timing and compliance. The tariff changes don't bite right away. They show up when seasonal demand ramps up, especially into Lent. At the same time, expanded FDA traceability rules mean not all fish is equally usable anymore. So whitefish in 2026 isn't just about pricing charts. It's about which supply chains can actually function smoothly under the weight of geopolitics, tariffs, bycatch limits, and compliance, and which one starts to crack at the margins.
Now, if you can't get enough of this content, you're in luck. Jason, tell them what they just won.
So when I was a kid, I used to read a lot of comic books. And there used to be a series called Marvel Team Up, where they would pair up superheroes from different groups. And that's essentially what we've done for seafood. I paired up several reporters on the editorial side with some of our price reporting team members. And we're preparing a series for you guys on seafood market X factors. Basically, the things coming in 2026 that could change the game for the seafood industry. It's going to be a series of stories. We'll start running them right before Christmas and wrap up right after New Year's. So you got something to look forward to, a little something under your tree and in your stockings, and consider it our holiday present to you.
Well, I'm actually feeling pretty good about 2026 after hearing from our awesome team here. And this episode did serve as our final episode, though.
But do not fret, we will be back. Your favorite seafood podcast will be returning Friday, January 23rd, with our highly anticipated Global Seafood Market Conference recap.
I cannot wait. The Undercurrent News team will be reporting live from the National Fishery Institute's annual conference taking place in Hollywood Beach, Florida. So keep your eyes peeled for that in the new year. And that actually reminds me, I have one more prediction, or maybe rather wish for the new year.
Okay, let's hear it.
So you know how NFI's Bob Dahan always makes those fun and creative antitrust videos to keep us on our toes?
Yes, I love them.
So
I liked the Taylor Swift one that he did.
Yes. So I'm really, really hoping for a K-pop Demon Hunters tribute. Ready for this? No price talks, no divisions of markets, no production limits.
No, I want to hear you keep going. I know you have more.
Well, if you want more, you're going to have to find us at GSMC. So,
at cocktail hour.
Maybe before cocktail hour. Anyway.
I don't sing before cocktail.
Thank you so much for listening to us this year. Lauren and I had a blast, and we cannot wait to bring you more coverage in the new year.
Bye-bye.